Florida's clean water problem, the manatee tragedy, and the Sundial Book Club goes to Key West. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The state is putting billions into restoring the Everglades and protecting water quality. Environmental advocates argue that's not enough. What immediate actions will be taken as algal blooms continue to grow? Also, manatees are dying off at faster rates than years past. Boats are not the primary issue. We'll talk with the state veterinarian about what she's found and if there's any hope. And finally,
you need to be unusual to end up living in Key West.
The Sundial team talked with author Lucy Burdett, the author of this month's Sundial Book Club selection, Key Lime Crime. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Algal blooms are back with a vengeance this summer, threatening the health, the environment, and the economy of the state. Blue-green algae has been found in Lake Okeechobee and other Central Florida waterways, leading to a health advisory in Palm Beach County. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is responsible for water management in Lake Okeechobee, is set to meet in July and is finalizing a lake management plan. How that water is managed and where releases will go may have ripple effects on coastal communities, inland municipalities, and, of course, just the health of the Everglades. Joining us now is Chief Science Officer for the Everglades Foundation, Steve Davis, and Tommy Stroud, Executive Director of the Lake Worth Drainage District. Both of you, thank you so much for the time today. Steve, if I may start with you, give us a sense of how bad the algal blooms are right now in the lake relative to what we saw just a few years ago in 2018, which was just horrible.
Well, hello, Luis, and thank you for allowing me to join the show. So the situation on Lake Okeechobee this year is actually somewhat unique compared to previous years. We saw the majority of the bloom developing before the onset of the wet season. In fact, we started to see the bloom developing in the month of April before there were any substantial inflows to the lake, which is, you know, primarily the source of pollution coming into the lake today. We had a couple of cold fronts pass over the lake, and with that, it's a large, shallow lake. With that, we see a stirring up of the muck on the bottom of the lake. So it suggests that this bloom that really reached its crescendo in mid-May, about 90%+ of the lake, 700 square miles of the lake, covered with blue-green algae. And so this is kind of a pollution from within story this year, that as the wet season now is developing and those inflows from that watershed to the north are picking up, will deliver more of that phosphorus and nitrogen to the lake. So we could see a longer window of blue-green algae on Lake Okeechobee.
And so with now you're being unique because now you're seeing it on the lake, what's the ripple effects? Now, that does that mean that we're going to experience what we did a few years ago on the coastal communities?
Great question. And so we're in a situation this year where we started the year with the lake levels a little bit higher and you know, a few feet higher than the recent years. So a higher lake moving into the wet season means that as those inflows pick up, the lake levels rise. And because of the changes in water flows throughout South Florida, that water from Lake Okeechobee, again, used to flow south to the Everglades. Now it's sent to the east and the west coast, down the St. Lucie River, down the Caloosahatchee River. So as we start to see the wet season pick up, lake levels rise very quickly, and we're likely to see discharge of that polluted and in some areas, toxic water to both of those coasts.
Tommy, we saw the scare. We talked about this not too long ago, you know, in West Palm Beach, with the water supply detecting toxic algae, and more than 100,000 residents' water was impacted. Is that something that you're worried about in Lake Worth and other coastal bodies? Can it seep around like that?
It's certainly a consideration, particularly for utilities that utilize surface water as a source for their potable water systems. And what you described on West Palm Beach, they have a surface water source, the lakes in and around West Palm Beach, and then a little further to the west is the West Palm Beach Water Catchment Area, another surface body of water. And that is connected through a series of canals back even to Lake Okeechobee. So in very dry conditions, they can rely on Lake Okeechobee for supplemental water. And it being a surface water source, it can be contaminated by algae like you described. In Lake Worth Drainage District, however, we have 13 or more utilities that rely on the groundwater that our system supports. But they are all groundwater sources for those utilities' potable water system. So that groundwater is any surface water that migrates down into the groundwater aquifer is filtered by the sands and silts and the geology of the underlying aquifer, so that by the time water reaches those aquifers, it's clear, pure drinking water. So, right, we don't have the same concerns because of the sources are different.
I see. Steve, do we have a sense why, kind of coming back to what you said, you mentioned the winter, but I just want to get a sense of why the algal blooms are at this point now. Why is it so unique? What happened?
Well, it's a few things, Lewis. And one, we need to recognize that the water quality issues that we experience are not just a result of events and conditions this year or the previous few years. What we see in many of our waterways, and Lake Okeechobee is a great example of this, is a buildup of nutrients, particularly phosphorus, over decades of loading. They accumulate in these water bodies, in these canals, in places like Upper Biscayne Bay, for example. And so the accumulation of those nutrients and then the mixing of that into the water column when conditions are right can fuel an algal bloom. And you know, we also have to consider the fact that we're also experiencing warming conditions. And so warmer waters favor some species of blue-green algae, particularly Microcystis, that we see blooming frequently on Lake Okeechobee. So we have a climate change effect where our waters are warmer for longer. We also have this accumulated legacy nutrient problem in many of our waterways that's playing out again and again.
And the other thing, too, is this. We talk about, you know, because that water gets released off into the estuaries on both coasts, but, you know, how else is it affecting the lake? And then, of course, the Everglades. Does it have the same impact on the Everglades?
Well, the really interesting thing about Everglades restoration and what Everglades restoration largely is it's reconnecting Lake Okeechobee back to the south, back to the water conservation areas, Everglades National Park. That helps to recharge the Biscayne Aquifer that communities from southern Palm Beach County all the way down to the Florida Keys depend on for their primary water supply. Everglades restoration at its core is about storing, cleaning, and sending water south. And the cleaning part is certainly relevant to this story. And the state has invested billions in the construction and management of 70 plus thousand acres of stormwater treatment marshes that clean the pollutants out of the water before it then goes to the Everglades. So with Everglades restoration, we not only send clean water south, but at the same time, we're cutting the need for those polluted toxic discharges to both coasts. So it's really a win-win situation in terms of restoration.
But a big portion of the lake right now is covered.
It really waxes and wanes, and it's a little bit less now than it was just last month. And that's partly because of the changes in inflows and partly due to changes in wind direction and speed. The blue-green algae that has flourished on Lake Okeechobee is buoyant. It floats to the surface, which gives it a competitive advantage over other algae that are deeper in the water. And because it's buoyant, it tends to move where the water moves. And so if you have wind blowing across the lake, you could go from a situation where it's completely covered to where it's all concentrated on the downwind side of the lake.
Mm. Tommy, I would love to be a fly on the wall when all of you water officials get together and start talking about the issue right now at hand. I wonder, what are these conversations right now when you talk about, the possible, and I know that Palm Beach, West Palm Beach especially, because as you mentioned, they take a lot of water from the surface. But what are the conversations like right now about the health of the lake, the Everglades, and, you know, these algal blooms and how it's impacting up and down the coast, all these different communities?
Well, I mean, that's a real good point. And you know, the issue of blue-green algae, while blue-green algae is a phenomenon that's existed in Florida for decades or even centuries, what Dr. Davis emphasized was the pollutant loadings into water bodies in really all of Florida, but particularly the contributing areas in South Florida, have created the potential for these large algal blooms. And occasionally they can become toxic just due to the physiology of the algal species. But you're right, it becomes an issue for water managers to have to deal with. And, you know, Lake Okeechobee's been known for decades as the liquid heart of South Florida, because virtually every major water conveyance is connected to it in some form or fashion. It's replumbing back in the 1950s and 60s had a huge detrimental impact to the Everglades and other parts of the ecosystem, including Lake Okeechobee. And Everglades restoration is a program to try to correct that. The blue-green algae issue is sort of a recent development that we're now adding to the host of issues that we're trying to sort through as we restore the ecosystem, restore Lake Okeechobee, but also try to provide a reliable water source for the residents of South Florida. And on a day-to-day basis, those are pretty interesting conversations as we try to work through them.
Yeah, lots of issues, lots of challenges. Again, I'm talking with Tommy Stroud. You just heard he's the executive director of the Lake Worth Drainage District. Also, Steve Davis, chief science officer for the Everglades Foundation. Again, algal blooms already in full force in Lake Okeechobee, raising concerns about our drinking water, raising concerns about the coastal environments and how it's going to impact our lives. Could this be one of those years like we saw back in 2018? Steve, Governor DeSantis signed an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers to build more than $3.4 billion water reservoir nearby. You're getting some support from the federal government as well. I believe President Biden's put in $350 million in his budget towards restoration here in South Florida. Given lawmakers are hoping for double that amount, is that $350 million enough? Is the money being spent by the state enough to do what's needed?
Well, we do need more, and more is based on the Army Corps of Engineers integrated delivery schedule that sort of maps out all of the projects that have been authorized by Congress, including the reservoir that you mentioned, that pivotal project that helps us to send more clean water to the south, and again, cutting those polluted discharges to the east and west coast. If you go by the Army Corps' integrated delivery schedule, we need over $700 million this year toward that restoration program, and over $1 billion the next 3 years. So we're talking about a substantial investment needed to keep projects like that reservoir on track and toward completion by the end of this decade. And you mentioned the $350 million. There was a bipartisan letter of support from the entire Florida delegation, from the furthest left to the furthest right of our state's representation in Washington, D.C., asking for $725 million this year from the federal government. And that is to be spread out, $725 million per year over the next 4 years, which will help us to meet that need for project construction over that period of time.
Yeah, as we mentioned, a couple times already, that the Army Corps of Engineers will set plans for water management for the lake later, coming up in July. Tommy, how do the local municipalities fit into that system of negotiations Is that something that you're also talking with them about? Because it's not just the algal issue that we're, blooms that we're dealing with. It's also, of course, the fact that we're coming into wet season, going in and out of dry season, and that may affect, again, how much water is available to the different communities up and down the coast. But I'm wondering, you know, what role, like, are you playing in those conversations?
Oh, yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, actually, as a governmental entity, we're a member of the Corps of Engineers project development team. So we sit and review the information that the Corps provides, and we're in a position, you know, to provide comment on issues that may be of concern for us with regard to the balancing of the various objectives that Lake Okeechobee tries to successfully achieve. And so we really appreciate that opportunity to be part of it. And the Corps got a tough job. They've got a lot of competing water resource objectives that they need to balance out while dealing, as I mentioned, with sort of a relatively newcomer, which is the potential health risk associated with these harmful algal blooms. So we're happy to be at the table and to be able to submit our comments and concerns. And we hope, you know, the Corps will take some consideration in them as they try to sort this out.
And of course, a story that we'll keep following, as they, when they come up to that point and make their decision. Steve, you have Congresswoman Lois Frankel, who's asked for a 90-day delay from the Army Corps in order to better understand the science behind this management. Do you believe that a delay would lead to better lake management, a better plan, I should say, or should the Corps remain on schedule?
Well, there's a lot of information to sort of wade through right now. We were just given the modeling output from the five alternatives that are being considered. And we at the Everglades Foundation have the capacity to actually run the same models. So we're also, in addition to looking at the outputs of those models, we're also looking at the inputs to understand how one or more of these alternatives can be optimized in a way to deliver the most balanced operational plan for Lake Okeechobee, because quite frankly, the lake has not been managed in a balanced way since we've been managing it. It's really been managed to provide for the needs of a few agricultural communities south of Lake Okeechobee, and we know that that often leads to holding of water in the lake until it's no longer needed, which leads to discharges. And it also leads to extreme dry conditions in the Everglades, where it is cut off from water for months at a time. And last year is a good example of that. That not only affects the ecology of the Everglades, a system that we're spending billions of dollars to restore, but it also threatens water supplies for communities along the Lower East Coast. So we're working towards a balanced alternative that cuts discharges, recognizing that you can't do everything with a change in operations. We certainly need the restoration infrastructure that I talked about earlier, but a balanced alternative should cut discharges to both coasts to some extent, or to the maximum extent,
right,
and also sending more water south to the Everglades during the dry season when that water is needed most.
Well, it is, again, they are going to make, or at least as far as we know, they're going to be making a decision on their plan coming up here in July. Again, a story that we will keep our eyes on. I want to thank Steve Davis, Chief Science Officer for the Everglades Foundation, and Tommy Stroud, Executive Director of the Lake Worth Drainage District. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks,
thank
Lewis.
You. It was an honor. Thank you.
Well, still to come, Florida's clean water problem has another victim, a lovable sea creature. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Manatees are an integral part of Florida's marine environment, but new research finds that they're dying off in record numbers. According to the state's Fish and Wildlife Commission, more manatees have died this year than all of last year. Boats have regularly caused problems for the threatened species, but a new issue has emerged. Their food supply is being impacted by Florida's polluted waterways. Dr. Martina DeWitt is a veterinarian for the FWC focused on manatees, and she joins me now. Dr. DeWitt, thank you so much for the time. More manatees have died this year so far, and we're only halfway through the year than all of last year. Okay, so what's happening?
Yeah, hi, Lewis. Thanks for having me. This year has been unprecedented for manatees on the Atlantic coast, both in numbers, as you just mentioned, and also the cause for these high mortality numbers. Through necropsies, which is the animal version of an autopsy, we have found that the primary cause of this unprecedented mortality event is from mass starvation, which is something that we have not documented on such a scale in manatees before.
Yeah, a lot of times we talk about manatees and we think about the issue of boats and manatees being hit, being struck by boats. But in this case, what you're saying is a lot of what you're seeing is manatees' food supply is running really low. Where are you seeing most of the deaths happen?
This event has stretched out over the whole Atlantic coast. Initially, in early December, it started to pick up in the central region, in the Indian River Lagoon. And then, which coincided with manatees moving south, we also saw the problems in southeast Florida. One of the main reasons for this is because the cause of that starvation, the lack of forage for manatees, is mostly in the Indian River Lagoon. So manatees that moved further south and then arrived in southeast Florida in January came there in malnourished condition. Then as temperatures warmed up and manatees moved north, the problems came with them in the northern parts of Florida. So it really encompasses the whole Florida, Atlantic coast, and also we've documented a couple cases in Georgia.
When you say, you know, they're getting skinnier, basically, because they're eating less, tell me what you've seen.
It's really, like I said, unprecedented to see adult animals in these large numbers starved to death is very unusual. A large proportion of the mortalities is adult animals. And normally you don't see them starve from disease. Often it's the juveniles that are affected by those diseases. And what we see in these animals is some are up to 40% underweight. And on the outside, you can see their skeleton, their bones sticking through their skin. Internally, when we do the necropsy examinations, we found that their internal organs show atrophy. It mostly affects their livers, their heart muscle, their fat tissue. It's really astounding.
It is to think about when you say that you could see their bones. I mean, we think of manatees and they're just these lovable, plump creatures floating along the water. To think of one so emaciated to the point where you're seeing the bones, that is frightening to think of. What is killing the seagrasses that they're eating, that they need to eat?
Yeah, well, you discussed this in the previous segment. It's a long-lasting problem in the Indian River Lagoon, where since 2011, 2012, there have been algal bloom after algal bloom after algal blooms, and some merged into super blooms, which has really had a negative effect on the water clarity there. And most of these blooms were brown tide, so on themselves, they are not toxic to manatees or other animal life. But with the water getting that murky, the seagrasses do not get enough light to grow. So over the years, and almost a decade now, there has been this die-off of seagrass, and it just reached the tipping point this year.
You know, if it takes that, you know, many years to get to the point now where you're seeing manatees starve, do we get a sense of how long it would take to recover? To regrow those seagrasses, to regrow that food source?
That's going to be not going to be resolved in a year or a few years. I mean, that's massive restoration that, you know, will take a long time. I'm not a seagrass expert, but you know, what I've seen, there have been efforts over the years, but it's just very challenging if the water quality does not cooperate with that. You know, it's really hard to grow those seagrasses back.
I'm talking with Martina DeWitt. She works with the Florida's Fish and Wildlife Commission, focused on manatees. And as we mentioned, they've been dying off in Florida this year in record numbers, in large part because of starvation. You could read more about the staggering numbers and what's been done to protect the population. Just head to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Martina, how many manatees have you been able to rescue from this situation? Do we know?
Yeah, it's the numbers, and these I have the number starting in December up to last week. We and our partners performed 67 rescues on the Atlantic coast. This included other causes as well, but many were manatees that were emaciated and needed that nutritional support and other medical support in rehab facilities.
What was the worst situation you saw that you were able to save them?
What was really impressive is these animals that are so underweight and are so weak, and they cannot even keep themselves upright in the water. They're listing to one side, and these animals in their blood work, they showed that they were at an end point of prolonged starvation. And it's a testament to all the medical care and the high tech manatee medicine that these animals receive, that the rehab facilities or our partners were able to turn these animals around and release them back into the wild.
And
some are still waiting their release.
When you release them, by the way, do you track them to make sure that we're seeing how they're doing?
Yes. Not every manatee gets tracked, but because obviously for the manatees that go back on the Atlantic coast, there is a concern for how they're going to do long term. Some of these animals have received a satellite tracker, so we can see where they eat, learn from that, and also keep an eye on them.
You know, every species plays its role in the ecosystem. And without it, that could just, you know, break the whole chain. But, you know, how would you describe the role that the manatee plays in our ecosystem and it, how important it is?
Yeah, manatees have been around in Florida for millions and millions of years ago. If you go back to the old fossils, there were manatees. And they do not have any natural predators. They themselves do not predate on anything, but they're just as part of the ecosystem as any animal in Florida. And they're a state marine mammal. So. You know, it's important for them to always be a part of Florida.
If things continue the way they're going, what concerns you the most? What could happen? They are a threatened species, just to mention, just to remind people.
They are a threatened species, correct. And this only comes on top of the threats that were already existing, such as watercraft injuries, and the loss of warm water habitat. We know that the manatee population was doing well based on models. And even when we mitigate those threats, there is still concern for the manatee population long-term. So now to add this on top of that, especially a cause that is so significant to their health, it's unlike a manatee surviving cold stress or a manatee surviving red tide. Like when you go through this prolonged starvation, it has negative health impacts on reproduction, on metabolism. And for manatees that went through that this winter to recover in time for this summer to reproduce and then again survive next winter, That's a major concern. Right now, manatees have dispersed. They are not restricted to the warm water sites around which we saw the most problems with the lack of food. So now they've made it to areas where they can regain their strength. But, you know, like I said, this is a prolonged situation. So there are serious concerns for their health.
Hmm. Dr. Martina DeWitt, veterinarian with Florida's Fish and Wildlife Commission. Martina, thank you so much for all of this information, and hopefully we find a solution quickly.
Thank you, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, you can learn more about the manatee die-off. Just go to our social media right now, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to switch gears, and we're going to go down to Key West. Our Sundial Book Club for June mixes crime, family, and key lime pie. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Key West is known for its laid-back lifestyle. But the book, The Key Lime Crime, shows us that the pastry chefs behind the island's sweet key lime pies are anything but laid-back. It's our Sundial Book Club for June. The mystery fiction culminates when a fancy chef brings a key lime puff pastry to a pie-baking contest. The city's pie aficionado and host of the contest is beside himself, to say the least. A fierce rivalry begins in Key West pie baking world. Someone gets pied in the face, but that's not the worst of it. One of the pastry chefs is mysteriously murdered. The story is part of the Key West Food Critic Mysteries book series by author Lucy Burdett, and we spoke with her yesterday. In real life, you are a clinical psychologist. So I wondered, at what point did you decide to go down the path of wanting to become a writer?
I started writing in the late 1990s when I had become obsessed with trying to play golf. And I was so bad, and I spent so much time working on it that my psychologist brain was saying, what can you do with this? How can you make something from it? And my first writing was articles about the psychology of golf, which, believe it or not, is a big field. And then when I had trouble placing a lot of these as a freelancer, a friend said, why don't you try writing a mystery? And it was like something clicked. I'd always read mysteries. I love mysteries. And so that's how it started. And now I'm on the third series, which is the Key West Food Critic series.
Well, that actually leads to my next question. Is golf still part of your life?
They tell people, write what you know. So I wrote about a neurotic lady golfer, and it fit perfectly. But she was trying to make her way onto the women's tour, and she had a lot of psychological issues that kept her from really competing at the level she should have been able to. And certainly I was nowhere near her level, but all that seemed interesting to me. The trouble is, it turns out that golfers don't have a lot of time to read, and readers hate golf. So I had to move on to something else.
So after the golf series, you had the advice columnist series, and then we're at the current series, which is the Key West Food Critic Mystery Series. What was the impetus for jumping, you know, from one series to the next, and now, you know, being in a totally different place and telling a totally different story?
It wasn't so much that I decided. I hate it. I do, when I was working as a psychologist, I did long-term psychotherapy, so I get very attached to my characters in the same way. But the publishing business really controls how long you can let a series go on. So when they see something's not selling well, for them to make the money they put into it, then it's axed. And that's what happened with the Golf Lovers Mysteries and then also the Advice Column Mysteries. And so I was looking for something new and heard about an editor who wanted a series about a food critic, preferably someplace tropical. and my husband and I were beginning to spend the winters in Key West. So, and I love food. I love to eat. I love to talk about food, write and read about food. So it seemed like a perfect match.
You live in Key West part of the year. When did you decide that you wanted to spend so much time in Key West? When did you move here?
We just fell in love with Key West. It's such an interesting place. Lots of art, lots of music, lots of book people. There are sports for my husband. There are ideas. If I get stuck, all I need to do is go outside and look around. And the characters and the quirky people are all around me. So we just loved it.
So you have an editor who's looking for a food critic story. It's got to be tropical. Okay, tell me about Haley Snow and where this story came from. And like with any of your characters, was there any inspiration for those characters? Or are these characters based on real people?
Some of the people in the books are actually based very closely on real people. Like I have a character named Lorenzo who reads tarot cards at Mallory Square at sunset, and that is very much a real person. His actual name is Ron, and I've gotten to know him, and every time I'm writing a book, I try to take him to lunch because he gives me so much insight into the island and the people, and also how he would think about what he does. Other characters like Miss Gloria, who is my main character's next door neighbor, she just popped up and took over. I wasn't looking for an old lady character, but she has kind of forced her way in, and it most people who write me about a character, she's the one they're most excited about. So Haley was like me. She had come to Key West. She didn't know the people. She didn't understand how the island works. She had come because a man invited her. And when that exploded, as it should have, she'd already gotten so attached to being there that she would do anything to stay. And she's evolved a lot. I'm not the kind of writer who can sit down and write a whole pages and pages of character sketches. These people get more alive to me the longer I write.
So Lucy, tell me, what makes the Key West food scene unique?
Well, there are the kinds of food that are special to Florida, not just Key West, but all of South Florida, key limes and mangoes and papayas, things that in the northern part of the country are just foreign to people. So that makes it special. I have met several people who are cooking down there. They're special people too, because you need to be unusual to end up living in Key West. It's expensive, and there are scary times with the hurricanes, and so I think it's just a different kind of people.
Again, I'm talking with Lucy Burdett. Her latest book is The Key Lime Crime. It is part of the Key West Food Critic Mysteries. Learn more about it on our website, WLRN.org. You know, I'm thinking about what you said with wanting to learn to play golf, learning the psychology of golf to be a better golfer. Did you learn how to write about food? Did you learn how to be a food critic? Because reading this, I felt this is a food critic.
I did. Again, it's something I've gotten better at. The second book that I wrote, which was called Death in Four Courses, there is a big literary seminar every year that's focused on a different subject. And the year I was writing that book, it was about food writers, which was so cool because all the New York Times food critics were there. Ruth Reitel was there, Frank Bruni. It was just jam-packed full of people whose specialty was writing about food. So I learned a lot from them. I learned that food is not just food. Food is about who you are and what you're giving and taking to the world. So that's helped me expand my idea of what I'm doing with it in the books.
Yeah. And look, it's one of the things too, as I'm reading through this, is, and that's why I brought that up, is, you know, whenever there are scenes or discussions about food, it's the way that it's written makes you think about the food, and you can either smell it or even taste it. All I'm going to say is this, it made me very hungry many times.
Yes, I warn people, don't read while hungry.
Or get yourself a slice of key lime pie.
Get yourself a snack, yes.
Exactly. I wonder, too, being in Key West as long as you have, has the famous literary heritage of Key West, you think about Hemingway and other great writers, as well as the setting for lots of crime fiction like Carl Hiaasen, how has that inspired you? Or maybe it hasn't, I don't know.
Well, it's inspiring, and it's also intimidating to think about what I'm doing and how it could possibly compare to people who are as well known as that. At the Custom House, which is a museum down near Mallory Square, they had an exhibit 2 years ago that was all about the literary people who had either lived or spent a lot of time in Key West. And somebody emailed me and said, you know, you're in that exhibit. And that was such a thrill. Because I know a lot of people don't consider mysteries to be serious literature, but I don't think it has to be that way.
But, you know, I think that's what Florida is so good at. I think perhaps it's the crime and mysteries. You know, looking at this book, you have Haley, who's writing a big piece about this upcoming Key Lime Pie competition. And then she also has to play host to her mother-in-law, which is always a fun thing to do, I'm sure. And then, of course, the interesting part about it is, not giving too much away, is that her mother-in-law finds this dead body. And now the story begins. I'm wondering for you, why does a small little touristy town like Key West make for such a great setting for a crime story?
Well, there are so many layers. I think that's part of it. The tourists who come in for a day, they see one thing. They see Duval Street and the bars and the outdoor restaurants and the t-shirt shops. That's one surface level. And then you stay there a month and you realize, no, there's a lot more to it. And then you stay there longer and you realize, no, there's even more to it than that, because people have lived here all their lives. They're called conks. And they experience it in a different way than a visitor ever would. So I never run out of ideas. You open up the newspaper and it's full of ideas. I don't know exactly what it is, but and it's so beautiful, and people aspire to be there and live there. So I think a lot of readers feel that magical connection without even visiting.
So, you know, Lucy, there's this moment in the story, there's a big, you know, key lime pie competition, which is part of the setting of the story. And I wondered, do people on the island take the key lime pie that seriously?
I don't know if the people, the actual conks who live there care that much about key lime pie. But certainly the tourists do. There is a real key lime pie festival that happens in July, I think, is when it's held. And David Sloan, who's a character in the book, is also the real person who runs that that festival. So almost every restaurant and almost every bakery serve key lime pie. So it seemed to me logical that there would be tension among them about who had the best.
I have to tell you, one of the things that you have a great Instagram account, love following it. And just because you have a lot of, you know, pics and recipes on there, pics of food, and just looks so yummy. For you, you know, how important is food in your life? It just seems like you know how to have so much fun with it.
You know, I don't consider myself a great chef, but as my husband will tell you, I have improved a lot over the course of these books because my character's always cooking, her mother's always cooking. We've had to go out to eat a lot to do the research, which is hard work, but somebody had to do it. And I just do care about food. I don't want to eat something out of a can. I don't always want to be the one to make it, but I want it to be good.
Yeah, no, you know what? That is a hard job. I envy you. I wondered, you had told me about why you write under a different name, under the pen name. And a lot of writers do this. This is not a surprise. Many writers have pen names. They write under different names. But, you know, where did Lucy Burdett come from and why decide to start writing under Lucy?
Right. My first two series were written as my regular name, which is Roberta Islib. And as I mentioned, those didn't sell as well as that publisher hoped for. So the new publisher, who wanted the tropical setting with the food critic, asked if I would be willing to change my name because that gives you a fresher start for orders and sales. It's really all very businesslike. And at that point, I said, fine, whatever, I'll do whatever it takes to be writing another series. And so my grandmother's name was Lucille Burdett, and she died when I was pretty young. So I thought it would be kind of neat to use her name and carry her forward in a way that she hadn't been able to. Besides, I like the name Lucy, and Burdett is so much easier than trying to explain how to spell Islib.
That's an interesting point. That's very good. I'm curious what your readers outside of Key West think of the island after reading the book. Do they ever talk about their perception of what life must be like for you?
People either love the idea of it or they hate the idea of it. What I think people sometimes don't realize is that everything in those books is filtered through my eyes. So it may not be completely accurate and it may not be exactly how other people experience it. And of course, although I put serious topics in there, it's a cozy mystery, so it's not supposed to be dark and heavy. So maybe Key West looks a little better on the page than somebody might see going there in person.
What are you working on now, Lucy?
I have the 11th book in this series coming out in August. It's called A Scone of Contention. Well, that one's long since done. And I'm working on number 12, which is due September 1st. And each one is exhausting and exhilarating.
That is author Lucy Burdett. Her latest book is The Key Lime Crime, a Key West food critic mystery. And it is the June title for the Sundial Book Club. Go to Facebook, look up Sundial Book Club to learn more. Ask to join. We'd love to have you. It's free. By the way, post on there for me, please. Where can I find the best key lime pie in Key West? Because I'm going there next month, and I want to find some. So please post that up on our Facebook page. Thank you so much. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, June 15th. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor and just all-around guy, Peter J. Mertz. And our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. GoPalo.com. Don't forget, download a podcast of this program. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, Marcy's Law was passed by Constitutional Amendment 3 years ago, intended to protect victims' identities, but the law is being used to protect the identities of police officers involved in police shootings. A new investigation from our reporter Danny Rivero into Marcy's Law coming up tomorrow. Plus, senior students at West Broward High School prep for graduation. They picked up their gowns, their caps, then no yearbook. School administrators brought the yearbook's distribution to a halt because it included a Black Lives Matter spread that they said was one-sided. Eventually, the yearbooks were distributed again, this time with a letter from the school principal saying the political views in the book are not sponsored by the district. We're going to learn more about this story. And don't forget about our book club. Again, just find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. We're going to talk about Key Lime Pies next week, but also we'll mention the book for July, because it's three books in July. I'll explain later. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, be good to each other, and remember, the program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.